Section 5 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931, by Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below, by Anthony Gilmore. Chapter 1. Machine Fish. Full stop. Rest ready. These words glowed in vivid red against the black background of the NX-1's control order board. A wheel was spun over, a lever pulled back, and in the hull of the submarine descended the peculiar silence found only in mile-deep waters. Men rested at their posts, eyes alert. Above, in the control room, Hemingway Bowman, youthful first officer, glanced at the teleview screen and swore softly. "Keith," he said, "between you and me, I'll be damned glad when this monotonous job's over. I joined the Navy to see the world, but this charting job's giving me entirely too many close-ups of the deadest parts of it." Commander Keith Wells, USN, grinned broadly. "Well," he remarked, "in a few minutes we can call it a day, or night, rather. And then it's back to the Falcon, while the day shift sees the world." He turned again to his dials as Hemi Bowman, with a sigh, resumed work. "Depth 6,000 feet, visibility poor, bottom 8,000, he said into the phone hung before his lips, and 50 feet aft in a small cubby a blue-clad figure monotonously repeated the observations and noted them down in an official geographical survey report. Such had been their routine for 2 tiring weeks, all part of the NX-1's present work of recharting the Newfoundland banks. As early as 1929, slight cataclysms had begun to tear up the seafloor of this region, and of late, 1935, seismographs and cable companies had reported titanic upheavals and sinkings of the ocean bed, changing hundreds of miles of underwater territory. Finally, Washington decided to chart the alterations this series of subsea earthquakes had wrought. And for this job the NX-1 was detailed. A super-submarine fresh from the yards, small but modern to the last degree, she contained such exclusive features as a sheathing of tough new glycosteel, automatic air rectifiers, a location chart for showing positions of nearby submarines, the newly developed Edsel electric motors, and automatic teleview screen. When below surface, she was a sealed tube of metal 100 feet long, and possessed of an enormous cruising radius. From the flower of the Navy, some 30 men were picked, and in company with the mothership Falcon, she put out to combine an exhaustive trial trip with the practical charting of the newly changed ocean floor. Now this work was almost over. Keith Wells told himself that he, like Bowman, would be glad to set foot on land again. This surveying was important, of course, but too dry for him. No action. He smiled at the lines of boredom on Hemi's brow as the younger man stared gloomily into the teleview screen. And then the smile left his lips. The radio operator, in a cubby adjoining the control room, had spoken into the communication tube. "Urgent call for you, sir, from Captain Knapp." Wells reached out and clipped a pair of extension phones over his ears. The deep voice of Robert Knapp, captain of the mothership Falcon, came ringing in. It was strained with excitement unusual to him. "Wells? Knapp speaking. Something damned funny's just happened near here. You know the fishing fleet that was near us yesterday morning?" "Yes." "Well, the whole thing's gone down. Destroyed, absolutely. The sea's been like glass, the weather perfect. Yet from the wreckage, what there is of it, you'd think a typhoon had struck. I can't begin to explain it. No survivors either, so far, though we're hunting for them." "You say the boats are completely destroyed?" "Smashed like driftwood. I tell you, it's preposterous. And yet it's the fact. I think you'd better return at once, old man. You're only half an hour off. And come on the surface. It's getting light now, and you might pick up something. God knows what this means, Keith. But it's up to us to find out. It's got me." His tones were oddly disturbed, almost scared, and this from a man who didn't know what fear was. "But, Bob," Keith asked, "how did you—" "Stand by a minute. The lookout reports survivors." Wells turned to meet Bowman's inquisitive face. He quickly repeated the gist of Knapp's weird story. "We saw them at dusk last evening, remember? And now they're gone, destroyed. What can have done it?" For some minutes the two surprised men speculated on the strange occurrence. Then Knapp's voice again rang in the headphones. "Wells? My God, man, this is getting downright fantastic. We've just taken two survivors on board. One's barely alive and the other crazy. I can't get an intelligible thing from him. He keeps shrieking about writhing arms and awful eyes, and monsters he calls machine fish." "You're sure he's insane?" Robert Knapp's voice hesitated queerly. "Well, he's shrieking about machine fish, fish with machines over them. I'm going to broadcast the whole story to the land stations. Machine fish. I don't know. I don't know. You'd better hurry back, Wells." He rang off. Keith slipped off the headphones and told Bowman what he had learned. Hardy, staunchly built craft, those fishing boats were, born in the teeth of gales. What horror could have ripped them, all of them, to driftwood, with the weather perfect, and a half-mad survivor raving about machine fish? "Such things are preposterous," Bowman commented scornfully. "But the fleet's gone, Hemmy," Keith replied. "Anyway, we'll speed back and see what it's all about." He punched swift commands on the control studs. "Empty tanks. Zoom to surface. Full speed." The crimson words glared down below, and the NX-1 at once shoved her snout up, trembling as her great electric motors began their pulsing whine. The delicate fingers of the mast dials before Keith danced exultantly. The depth levels told out 7,000, 6,000, 5,000. "Keith, look there." Hemmy Bowman was pointing with amazement at the location chart, a black mesh screen that showed the position of other submarines within a radius of 2 miles. In one corner, a spot of vivid red was shining. "But it can't be a submarine," Wells objected. "Our reports would have mentioned it." The two officers stared at each other. "Machine fish," Bowman whispered softly. "If there were machines, the metal would register on the chart." "It must be them," the commander roared, coming out of his daze. "And by God, we're going after them." Rapidly he brought the NX-1 out of her zoom to the surface and left her at 4,000 feet in perfect trim while he read the instruments closely. A green spot in the center of the location chart denoted the NX-1's exact position. A distance of perhaps 40 inches separated it from the red light on the meshed screen, which represented roughly 1.5 miles. Below the chart was a thick dial over which a black hand indicating the mysterious submersible's approximate depth was slowly moving. "He's sinking, whatever he is," Keith muttered to Hemmy. "Hey, Sparks, get me Captain Knapp." A moment later the connection was put through. "Bob, this is Wells again. Bob, our location chart shows the presence of some strange undersea metallic body. It can't be a submarine, for my maritime reports would show its presence. We think it has some connection with the machine fish that survivor raved about. At any rate, I'm going after it. The world has a right to know what destroyed that fishing fleet, and since the NX-1 is right on the spot, it's my duty to track it down. Rebroadcast this news to land stations, will you? I'll keep in touch with you." Knapp's voice came soberly back. "I guess you're right, Keith. It's up to you. So long, old man. Good luck." In Wells's veins throbbed the lust for action. With control studs at hand, location chart and teleview screen before his eyes, and 15 men waiting below for his commands, he had no fear of any monster the undersea might spew up. He glanced swiftly at the location chart and depth indicator again. The mysterious red spot was slowly coming across the NX-1's bows at a distance of about 1 mile. Keith punched a stud, and as his craft filled her tank and slipped down further into deep water, he spoke to Hemmy Bowman. "Take control for a minute. Keep on all speed, and follow him like a bloodhound. I'm going below." He strode down the connecting ramp to the lower deck, where he found 15 men standing vigilantly at posts. At once Keith plunged into a full explanation of what he had learned up in the control room. He concluded, "A great moral burden rests on us, every one of us, as we will soon come face to face with a possible world menace. Anything may happen. A state of war exists on this submarine. You will be prepared for any wartime eventuality." Sobered faces greeted this announcement, and perceptibly the men straightened and held themselves more alertly. Wells at once returned to the control room. A glance at the location chart and its two tiny lights told him that the intervening distance had been decreased to about a half a mile. The depth dial showed them both to be 2 miles below, and steadily diving lower. Charts showed the seafloor to be 3 miles deep in this position, and that meant... "Look there!" exclaimed the first officer suddenly. "It's changing course!" The Crimson Stud had suddenly shifted its course, and was now fleeing directly before them. For a moment the distance between the green and red lights remained constant, and then Keith Wells stared unbelievingly at the chart, wiped a hand across his eyes, and stared again. Why, the devils are as fast as we are!" he exclaimed in amazement. "I think they're even gaining on us. And there's no other submarine in the world that can do more than 30 underwater," Hemi Bowman added. "We're hitting a full 41. A call came through the communication tube from Sparks. "Report from Consolidated Radio News Broadcasters, sir. Aimed especially at us." "Well?" asked Keith, motioning Hemi to listen in. Sparks read it. "A week ago, Atlantic City reported that 7 men were snatched off fishing boat by unidentified tentacled monsters. Testimony of witnesses was discredited, but was later corroborated by the almost identical testimony of other witnesses at Brighton Beach, England, who saw man and woman taken by mysterious monsters while bathing. Perhaps these same creatures destroyed the Newfoundland fishing fleet." His level voice ceased. "Tentacled monsters. Machine fish," Wells murmured slowly. "Machine fish." Their eyes met, the same wonder in each. "Well," Keith rapped at last, "we're seeing this through." He turned again to the location chart. The green spot, as always, was in the center, and at a constant distance was the red, showing that the NX-1 was hot on the other's trail. The depth dials indicated that both were diving deeper every moment. "Where in hell's it going?" the commander rasped. "We'll be on the floor in a few minutes." Here the teleview showed the world to be one of fantasy, one to which the sun did not exist. It was not an utter pitchy blackness that pervaded the water, but rather a peculiar dark blueness. No fish schools, Keith noted, scurried from them. They had already left these waters, aware, perhaps, of the passing terror. They plunged lower yet. Wells was conscious of Hemi Bowman's quick, uneven breathing, conscious of the tautness of his own nerves, strung like quivering violin strings, conscious of the terrific walls of water pressing in on them, and conscious of the men below, their lives bound implicitly in his will and brain. A thought came to him, and quickly he reached into a rack for the chart of the local seafloor, his brow creased with puzzlement as he studied it. "Here's more mystery, Hemi," he muttered. "Look. There's an underwater cliff about half a mile dead ahead. It rises to within 4,000 feet of the surface. And that thing out there is charging straight into its base." "They must be aware of it," jerked the other. "See? They've stopped." It was true. The gulf between the two colored spots was rapidly being swallowed up. At a pulsing 41 knots, the NX-1 was closing in on the motionless mystery craft. "They're sinking to the floor itself," observed Wells. "Perhaps waiting to attack." The invisible beams from their ultraviolet light beacons streamed through the silent gloom outside, yet still the teleview screen was empty. Keith punched a stud, and the NX-1's whining motors dulled to a scarcely audible purr. "What is the thing?" muttered Hemi Bowman. "God, Keith, what is it?" For answer, the commander dropped them the last 500 feet. The seafloor rose like a gray ghost. More control studs were pushed. The order board below read, "All power off, rest in trim." The location chart told a tale that wrung a gasp from Bowman's throat. The red and green lights were practically touching. The hands of Petty Officer Brown, the helmsman, were quivering on the helm. Wells's fists kept tensing and relaxing as he peered for a sight of the enemy in the teleview. Nothing showed but the moving fingers of spectral kelp. Then both he and Bowman cried out as one. "There!" End of chapter 1. Section 6 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931. By Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below by Anthony Gilmore. Chapters 2 and 3. Chapter 2. The Silent Ray. A strange shape had suddenly materialized on the screen, an immense oval-shaped thing of dull metal with great curving cuts of glass-like substance in its blunt bow, like staring eyes. A lifeless, staring thing, stretching far into the curtain of gloom behind. How long it was, Keith could not tell. At first his numb brain refused to grasp it and reduce it to definite, sane standards of size and length. The cold weeds of the seafloor, kelp beds, swayed eerily over and around it. From its bow, he saw, peculiar knobs jutted, the function of which he guessed with dread. Was it waiting with a purpose? Was it waiting? An inviting attack? A frightened whisper from Hemi Bowman broke the hush.
Keith, the thing has ports, but shows no lights. What kind of creatures can they be?
As he spoke, the three men in the control room felt the unmistakable jarring tingle of an electric shock, and while their nerves still jumped, it came again, and again. They were conscious of a slight feeling of drowsiness. Keith gaped at Bowman and Brown, and then a flash on the teleview screen drew his eyes. There, against the blackness of its otherwise inanimate hulk, one of the jutting knobs on the bow of the mysterious submarine was glowing and pulsing with orange life. With it came the tingling shock again. It flicked off as they watched, then returned and went once more. "They're attacking, but thank God the shock was harmless," Wells said grimly. "All right, they've asked for it. I'm going to see how they like the taste of a torpedo." The two submarines were resting on the ocean floor with perhaps 200 feet between them. The NX-1's bow tubes were not exactly in line to score a direct hit. She would have to be maneuvered slightly to port. The range was short. The explosion from the torpedoes would be titanic. Keith punched the control studs, ordering the men below to assume firing stations. Then, while waiting for the NX-1 to shift, he studied the teleview screen to sight the range exactly. The black dot which represented the enemy craft was not directly on the crossed hairlines of the dial-like rangefinder, but shifting the NX-1 a few feet would bring it to the perfect firing point. But the NX-1 did not budge. Surprised, her commander swung and looked at Bowman. "What the devil?" he cried. "Did that shock?" He left the dread thought unfinished and leaped to the speaking tubes. "Craig! Jones! Weatherby!" he yelled. "Men, don't you hear me? Aren't you—" He broke off, wordless, waiting for an answer that did not come, then sprang to the connecting ramp and ran to the deck below. The scene, he found, halted him abruptly in his tracks. Every member of the crew was sprawled on the deck in grotesque, limp postures. They had been standing rigidly at posts, he saw, when the thing, whatever it was, had struck. Without a sound, without a single cry of alarm, the NX-1's crew had been laid low. The commander slowly advanced to the deck and stared more closely at the upturned faces around him. He saw that every man's eyes were open. Bending over one still form, he pressed his hand on the heart. It was beating. The man was alive. Amazed, he moved to another and another. They were all breathing, slowly and regularly. Were all alive. A curious look in their eyes staggered him for a moment. He could swear that they recognized him, knew he was staring at them. For every single pair was alight with intelligence, and Keith fancied he saw gleams of recognition. "It must have been a paralyzing ray," he gasped. "A thing our scientists have been trying to develop for years. And that monster outside knows the secret." He lifted an arm of the inert figure at his feet. When he released the grip, it flopped limply back to the deck again. "Keith! Come back! Quick!" Startled, the commander turned to find Hemingway Bowman at the top of the connecting ramp, his face distorted with alarm. "For God's sake, come back quick!" he yelled again. "Down there, the ray might get you." With the words, Wells leaped to the ramp and raced to the control room. He had no sooner made it than he felt again the queer tingle of the electric charge. He found himself trembling. Bowman's face was white. His words came stuttering.
"One second later, and they'd have got you. They got Sparks in his cubby. You see, the ray doesn't affect us in the control room because—"
"Because the Gibson insulation that protects the instruments keeps it out," Keith finished grimly.
"I see."
Just then a slight jar ran through the submarine. Coincident with it came a cry from Brown, the helmsman. His arm was pointed at the teleview.
There they saw the enemy's mighty dirigible of metal was now within 30 feet of the NX-1. It had crept up silently, without warning, and spanning the short gulf between them, an arm of webbed metal craned from the other's huge bow, hooking tightly into the American submarine's forward hawser holes. As they took this in, the enemy ship moved away, and the arm of metal tightened. The NX-1 shuddered, and at first slowly, but with ever-increasing speed, she got under way and slid after her captor. They were being towed away. Kidnapped. Men, submarine, and all. Keith Wells mopped sweat from a hot brow and rapidly reviewed his weapons. He was sorely restricted. Through an emergency system, the NX-1 could be propelled and maneuvered from her control room, but the torpedo tubes needed local attendance. "Hemi, reverse engines," he jerked, himself spinning over a small wheel. "Let's see if we can outpull the devil." At once they felt the shock of the paralyzing ray, and then the surging whine of the Edsel electrics pulsed up, and in the teleview screen they watched the grim struggle of ship against ship. Imperceptibly, almost, as her screws cut in and churned, the forward progress of the NX-1 was slowing, the speed of the other being cut down until finally they but barely forged ahead. Slowly, ever so slowly, they were outpulled. Inch by inch they were dragged ahead. Their motors could not hold even. "She's more powerful than we," Wells' bitter voice spoke. "Damn," he thought desperately, while Bowman and Brown stared at the fantastic tale the teleview spelled out. Again the paralyzing shock tingled, an intangible jailer that bound them, more surely than steel bars, to the control room. To dare that streaming barrage meant instant impotence, and perhaps later, death. "Our two bow torpedoes," Keith mused slowly. "We're a bit close, but it's our only chance. The ray comes at intervals of about a minute. The torps are ready for firing. If one of us could dash forward and discharge 'em. Brown, that's you." The petty officer met his commander's gaze levelly. He smiled. "Yes, sir, I'm ready," he said. "Good. It'll have to be quick work, though. I'll try and keep the sub pointed straight. Wait for the ray, then run like hell." The first officer took over the helm, and Brown stepped to the forward ladder, waiting for the periodic ray to be discharged. The odd tingle came and vanished. "Now!" Wells roared, and Brown leaped down the thin steel rungs. He staggered at the bottom from the force of his impact, then straightened and raced madly forward. Through the drone of the motors the two officers could hear the staccato beat of his feet, but their eyes were glued to the teleview. Through clutching beds of seaweed the enemy submarine was plowing. Her great smooth bow lay straight ahead, metal hawser arm spanning the 30 feet between them. In another second, Keith thought grimly, two dynamite-packed tubes of sudden death would thunderbolt into that hull, and Brown pulled the lever. The tubes spat out compressed air. A scream ran through the submarine, and the two steel fish leaped from their sheaths, their tiny props roaring. Over the narrow gulf they shot. The range was short, their target dead ahead, and yet, by bare inches, they missed. No answering roar bellowed back. Keith had watched their course, had seen them flash by the enemy's bow, flicking it with their rudders, but nothing more. "Why?" he cried, and as Bowman moved his hands in a hopeless gesture he saw in the teleview the reason. It was a jagged pinnacle of rock, which, just before Brown had fired, had been straight ahead. The towing monster had seen it and veered sharply to avoid crashing. The barest change of course, yet sufficient to avoid the torpedoes. Wells and Bowman were cursing savagely when the sound of Brown, racing desperately aft, jerked the commander to the ladder. He saw the petty officer at its foot. "Hurry!" Wells shouted. "The ray!" Brown grasped the steel rungs and scrambled upward, but he was too late. The fatal charge tingled. A peculiar, surprised expression washed over his face. His hands loosened their grip. For a second his eyes looked questioningly at his commander. A faint sigh escaped him, and then his arms were flung out, his body relaxed, and he slumped like a slab of meat to the deck below. Keith Wells saw red. Blind to everything, he was just about to charge down the ladder to himself reload the forward tubes, when the grip of Hemi Bowman's hand stayed him. The thing Hemi was staring at in the teleview screen sobered him completely. The wall of rock to which the enemy submarine had first been charging had become visible, soaring vastly from the gloom of the seafloor, and the monster was towing them straight into a dark, jagged cleft at its base. "It's a cavern," Keith breathed. "A split in the rock, the lair of that devil, and we're being dragged into it." Chapter 3. Sacrifice. At that moment, Keith Wells knew fear. Each second they were being hauled closer to the monster's dim lair. It lay there, dark, mysterious, fingered by gently swaying, clammy kelp. A hushed solitude seemed to reign over it, awing all undersea life from the vicinity. Wells turned his head to meet Bowman's eyes, and read in them a silent question. What now? He groaned in the agony of his mind. In a few minutes, all would be over. Once the NX-1 was dragged into that dark cavern, there'd be no chance of escaping to warn the world above, of saving the submarine. What now? The question brought beads of sweat to his tormented brow. He, Keith Wells, standing impotently by while his ship, the pride of the service, was hauled inch by inch to some strange doom. Racked by these thoughts, he murmured tortured, jerky phrases, unconscious he was giving voice to the things that flogged his brain. What can I do? I've got to save my ship. I've got to get back to break the news. I've got to tell the world. But how? How? His expression changed suddenly. That's it. That hawser arm between us must be broken. Yes. First Officer Hemingway Bowman's clear voice broke in on the older man's thoughts with that one crisp word. Keith swung to find the other's eyes fixed levelly on his. You're right, Keith. The hawser arm must be broken. With a depth charge, of course. It's the only way. To attach a depth charge, he continued evenly, a man must leave the ship. You can't, Keith. It will be me. The commander did not speak. I'll put on a sea suit, Hemi went on quickly, eyes lighting. You tip the submarine, and I'll slide out the conning tower exit port on the lee side, so they can't see me, and worm forward through the kelp. We're almost holding them even. That'll be easy. I'll be protected from the paralyzing shock until the last second, and it may not get me outside. That'll have to be chanced. The hawser arm's only some 10 feet above the seafloor. I can reach it with a hook on the charge. He paused. I'll attach it, and when it bursts, I'll try to get back and grab that ring on the midship's exit port. And you can let me in when we get to the surface. But if I take too long, Keith, if I miss, you beat it without me, you understand? Beat it. He gazed straight at his friend. Understand, Keith? Commander Keith Wells bowed his head in acquiescence. He was afraid that if he met Hemi Bowman's steady eyes, he'd make a fool of himself. Hemi glanced at the screen once more, shivering as he saw how near the black cavern was. Then he moved rapidly, playing the cards carefully for his gamble with death. He had to. The trumps were in the other hand. From the locker where their sea suits were stowed, he grabbed his own, and with quick fingers ripped the slides and fitted it on. A sheath of yellow Lesto fabric, its weighted feet and gleaming casque, transformed his slim figure into a giant such as might stalk through a nightmare. Built cunningly into the helmet was a tiny radio transmitter and receiver with a range of a quarter mile. Hugging to the shoulders, inside nestled the air-making mechanism, its tiny generators already in motion. Around the helmet was fastened a small removable undersea light. The wrists of the suit were very flexible, permitting the freest motion. Once in the suit, Hemi smiled through the still-opened face shield. Got the depth charge ready, Keith? Make it fast. That cavern's near. Good. Silently, the commander fitted the black bomb to his friend's shoulders. It was timed to fire a minute after being set. A long wire hook craned from its top, and this hook Bowman would fasten on the hawser arm. Without sparks, I guess I'll have to communicate with you through portable, Keith said, and quickly donned one of the tiny portable sets. Right. Ready, Keith. Bowman started his awkward, crawling progress up the ladder into the conning tower just above, Keith helping him from behind. When they stood before the exit port on the lee side, Wells shot back its bolts and the door swung open, revealing the black emptiness of the water chamber. The commander gazed for a second into Bowman's eyes. The moment had come. Keith turned his head away, felt a hand grip his. He wrung it tightly. Bowman clumped into the chamber. The commander closed and locked the door, and he heard the streaming water pour in as Hemi turned the valve. Then Wells sped down the ladder and tilted the diving and course rudders of the submarine. She swayed daintily over to port, held there. A moment later the recurring electric tingle brushed him. Had the enemy seen Bowman leave? Had the ray struck him down? He glared into the teleview. Thank God, he breathed, for Hemi had already slid down the NX-1's smooth hull and was safe on the seafloor beside her. "Everything right?" Wells asked, speaking into the microphone of his portable. "All okay," came the answer. "Going forward now. Kelp thick as hell." Keith's eyes bored at the screen. This misshapen monster who was his friend, almost obscured by bands of thick-leaved kelp, the yellow form moved, hands clearing a pathway through the weeds. Slowly but surely he made for the bow of the submersible. "Hard going, Keith. God, the cavern's right ahead." It was ghostly to hear Hemi's warm voice from the lifeless solitude outside. Breath coming quickly, Wells watched the silent scene, the cleft in the wall of rock overshadowing everything now. The diver fought ahead, gaining inch by inch. Now, save for occasional clumps of weed, he was exposed to the enemy. Now the last desperate gauntlet was reached. Keith felt his blood pound hotly. "I'm gaining, Keith. Gaining." Bowman had little breath for speech. His tiny form battled on, now sinking from sight as he dropped into some masked gully, now wrestling slowly with great swaying strands of kelp, but always struggling ahead. "I'm at the bow, Keith. The hawser arm's right in our mooring holes. I'll go halfway before fastening the charge. Any signs of life from the devil?" "None yet, Hemi. But go slow. Hide all you can, old man, for God's sake." Right beneath the metal arm, Bowman's dwarfed figure crept doggedly ahead. Forward, inch by breathless inch, kelp thickened, washed away. The two hulking submersibles, captor and captive, surged onward, but just a little faster went the valiant figure with the black charge on its back. The towing monster had its snout in the cavern. The darkness thickened. Bowman was quarter way. He plunged desperately. Halfway. "I'm there, Keith. Now for it." "Oh God," Wells cried. "They see you. They're coming." For he had seen strange shapes leaving the enemy submarine, and at that same moment Bowman saw them too. They came like the blink of a dark eye from a door that had quickly slid open in the mysterious ship's bow. As tall as a man they were, and there were two of them, though at first the nature of their bodies merged with the wreathing kelp made them seem like a dozen. Bowman stared at them, hypnotized with fear. His legs and arms went dead, and his whole gallant spirit seemed to slump into lifeless clay. Now he knew why the fishermen had shrieked machine fish. Each one of them had eight tapering arms, eight restless tentacles. These were octopi, most hideous scavengers of the ocean floor, and not only octopi, but octopi sheathed in metal-scaled armor. As they came closer, he realized this preposterous fact. The dark substance of their writhing tentacles was not flesh. It was a coat of metal scales, and the fat central mass which held their eyes and vital organs and beaked jaw, this mass was completely enveloped by a globe of glass. From inside he could see the great eyes staring at him. The monsters came towards him, quite slowly, obviously wary, advancing over the seafloor in what was a hideous mockery of walking, their forward tentacles outstretched. With a sob, Hemi Bowman pulled himself from his trance. He glanced back at the NX-1. He still had time to retreat. He might be able to get back inside before these monsters seized him. But that meant abandoning his job, and already his own submarine was nosing into the cavern. The choice between the octopi and retreat stared him in the face. He pulled himself together and jerked his arms back into action. Eyes bulging, Keith Wells peered at the dim teleview screen. He saw the creatures approaching Hemi, and then, suddenly, he remembered his radiophone. "Hemi, come back, for God's sake," he cried. "Come back while you can. It's hopeless." But Bowman had already seized the depth charge from his back and hooked it on the hawser arm above. Immediately with that action all caution fled from the approaching monsters. Their tentacles whipped furiously, and in a great arc they sprang for the tiny figure of the diver. With a deep breath, Hemmy staggered forward to meet them. "Keith," he gasped, "I'll try to hold him away from the charge. When it bursts, zoom. Zoom like hell to the surface." And then the tentacles had him. Keith watched, cursing his impotence to help. Hemmy had no weapon. He was trying to hold them back by the weight of his body. He reached out and grasped a tentacle and hugged it to him, shoving forward with all his puny strength. But all his effort was as nothing. One of the octopi writhed past him and darted into the depth charge. Its tentacles tugged at the bomb, pulled furiously. The time charge exploded. The NX-1 rocked like a quivering reed. Wells was knocked violently to the floor. A vast roar smote his eardrums. When he staggered to his feet, he found that the octopus that was pulling at the charge had disappeared, blown into fragments of flesh and metal. But the hawser arm was broken. The NX-1, free, shot back a full 50 feet under the pull of her reversed screws. A cry echoed in her commander's ears. "Go back, Keith! Go like hell!" He saw the remaining octopus lift Bowman and whip to the exit port of its submarine. The lids slid into place, closing on the monster and his friend, and the enemy ship vanished into the black cavern. Once clear of the opening, Keith set his motors full forward and brought the diving rudders up. Quickly the ship sped from the haunted seafloor to the sun-warmed surface. A last thin call rang in his radiophone. "They've got me inside, Keith. It's dark and filled with water. I can't see anything, but I guess we're going through the cavern. Forget about me, old boy. So long. So—" The voice was abruptly cut off. Keith ripped the instrument from his head. Then, face white and drawn, he ran to the radio cubby. Standing over Sparks' inert body, he put through a call to Robert Knapp on the Falcon. "Knapp," he said harshly, "this is Wells. I'll be with you in a few minutes. Yes, yes, I'll tell you the whole story later. But get this now. Have the day shift all ready to take over the submarine by the time I pull alongside." He said no more just then, but rang off. And looking back, he muttered savagely, "But I'll be back, Hemmy. I'll be back." End of chapters 2 and 3.
Section 7 of Astounding Stories 14, February 1931. By Various. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tentacles from Below by Anthony Gilmore. Chapters 4 and 5. Chapter 4. In the Cavern. "That's the story, Knapp. They got Bowman, and I had to run away. Their ship disappeared into the cavern. I've got a hunch, though, that it's not just a cavern, but a tunnel leading through to some underwater world. That series of subsea earthquakes probably opened it up, and now these devil octopi are free to pour out. I've got to find out what's what, and that's why I'm going down again as soon as the torpedo system's ready." Keith and Robert Knapp were in the Falcon's chart room. On the table before them lay a broad white map with a cross mark indicating the position of the mysterious dark cavern. Wells was striding up and down like a caged tiger in his impatience to be off. Every other minute he glared down to where the NX-1 lay alongside. On her conning tower stood the tall, blond-haired figure of Graham, the first officer of the day shift, supervising the final details of the work of installing a system of jury controls whereby the submarine's torpedoes could be fired from her control room. Keith stopped short and faced Knapp. "It won't be so one-sided this time, Bob," he promised. "You see, when the location chart shows the enemy ship, I'll rush all men into the control room, where the paralyzing ray can't harm them. I don't know but what they have in other weapons, but I'm gambling on getting my torps in first. They've killed Bowman. They've ravaged a whole fishing fleet. They're free to emerge from their hole and maraud every ocean on the globe. They've got to be stopped. And since I'm armed and have the only submarine on the spot, I've got to do it. I know how to fight them now." Captain Robert Knapp's sense of things was badly disordered. He had just heard a story which his common sense told him couldn't be true, but which the evidence of his eyes had grimly authenticated. He had seen 15 men slung aboard his ship from the NX-1's silent hull, men stretched in grotesque, limp attitudes, men struck down by a paralyzing ray. Why, no nation on Earth had developed rays for warfare. Yet a crew of helpless men was even then in the sick bay, receiving attention in the hope that they might recover.
"You're going right through that cavern, then, Wells?" he asked incredulously. "You're going to investigate what lies beyond?"
"Nothing else. And I won't come out till I've blown that octopi ship to pieces."
"It sounds preposterous," Knapp murmured, shaking his head. "Octopi, you say, and clad in metal suits, running a submarine more powerful than the NX-1, armed with a ray, a paralyzing ray. I can't believe, I can't conceive."
"You've seen the men. Knapp, if I were you, I'd swing my 8-inchers out, bring up the plane catapult, and keep the deck torpedo tubes loaded and ready. It's best to be prepared. God knows what's going on undersea these days."
First Officer Graham appeared at the door.
"Work finished, sir," he said. "Ready to cast off."
"Thank heaven," Wells muttered, and stretched out his hand to Robert Knapp. "Broadcast what I've told you, Bob, and say that the NX-1 won't be back till everything's under control. I'll keep in touch with you. So long." And he was gone before the captain could even wish him good luck.
Orders raced from her commander's fingers on the studboard in the control room. Crash dive filled her tanks and put her nose perilously down, so that in 30 seconds only a swirling patch of water was left to show where once she'd lain. A brief command to the helmsman, and she pointed straight for the dark cavern marked on the chart. When well under way, Keith descended with Graham to inspect the new torpedo firing system, and found it in good working order.
"Graham," he ordered tersely, "instruct the crew fully about rushing to the control room on one ring of the general alarm, and send the cook up to me in a minute or so. I'll be in Sparks' cubby."
Above again, he instructed the radio man to rig a remote control sender and receiver in the insulated control room. The need for centering the whole crew there during engagements would crowd the room awkwardly, but at other times, while proceeding on their inspection of the cavern lair, they could remain at their regular posts. That, at least, was Wells's plan.
He looked up and found the cook, McKegnie, grinning at him from the door of the control room. Keith smiled, running his eyes over the portly magnificence of his gently perspiring figure.
"Keg," he said cheerfully, "I want you to move your hot plate and culinary apparatus up here. You see, we're all likely to be crowded in here for some time, and your coffee's going to be an absolute necessity." He couldn't resist a crack at McKegnie's well-known and passionate curiosity as to what made the thingamajigs of the control board work, and besides, it'll give you a chance to observe the instruments and perfect yourself for your future career as a naval officer. Much better than a correspondence course in how to be a submarine commander, eh?
Cook McKegnie grinned sheepishly and left.
He was well used to such jests, but he never would admit that his extraordinary interest in watching the ship's wheels go round was accompanied by a miraculous inability to comprehend why they went round.
15 minutes later, the helmsman's cry, "Cavern showing, sir," swung the commander to the teleview screen. The dark, kelp-shrouded opening he knew so well was already looming on it, and he was prepared.
"Enter," he said, while his punched studs ordered, "Quarter speed, ready at posts, tanks in trim." The NX-1 slackened her gait, balanced cautiously, and struck a straight, even course as she crept closer to the cleft entrance through which, some 2 hours earlier, the octopi ship had nosed. Screws turning slowly, she edged through the jagged cavern. Shades of inky blackness grew on the teleview and danced in fantastic blotches. The screen turned to a welter of black, threatening shadows, became a useless maze of ever-changing forms. Keith mouthed curses as he stared at it. Now he had nothing by which to judge his progress, to maneuver the submarine, save directional instruments and perhaps chance scrapings of the tunnel's ragged walls against the outer hull. The NX-1 was running a gauntlet of immeasurable danger, her only assurance of success being the fact that a larger craft had preceded her. But how far, Keith wondered, had that ship preceded her? How was he to know that it had gone straight through? There might be a dozen different turnings in this tunnel.
The submarine could easily tilt head-on against a jagged rock and puncture her hull. There might be mines planted directly in their course. He might be swimming straight into some hideous ambuscade. The passage had to be made on the fickle authority of the senses, and realizing this, Wells took the helm into his own hands. Graham was posted at the location chart with instructions to report the red light if it showed. Down below, the Edsel electrics were humming very softly. The men stood vigilantly at posts. On their brows were little beads of sweat, and here and there a hand clenched nervously. All knew they were in a tight place. Otherwise they were ignorant of where their commander was leading them. Occasionally a long shivering rasp ran through the ship as her hull nudged the rough tunnel wall. Then the course rudders would swing gently over, and perhaps, almost immediately, another grinding cry of rock and steel would come from the other side. Then would come quickly indrawn breaths as the rudders swung again and the humming silence droned on. The scrapings came quite often. Often, too, the motors would go silent altogether, and the NX-1 would rest almost motionless as her commander felt for an opening. It was a tense, nerve-wringing ordeal. The silence, the waiting, the dainty scrapings were maddening. Keith Wells's skin was prickling. He kept only fingertips on the tiny helm. He was playing that uncanny sixth sense of the submarine commander. When it misled him, the rasping rock groaned out, scarring the submarine's smooth skin. Generally, the tunnel was straight, but each time he heard his ship rub against some exterior obstruction, his teeth went tight, for who knew but what it might be a mine? They had penetrated perhaps a half mile when Graham, eyes steady on the teleview, reported, "Light growing, sir." Wells saw that the screen was filling with a soft, faintly glowing bluish color. The walls of the tunnel became visible, and he noted that they were widening out, funnel-like. He dared to increase speed slightly. 3 minutes later, he saw that the blue illumination was seeping from the end of the tunnel. They continued out. "Thank God we're through," he muttered to Graham. "You see, I was right. It's an underground sea, and we're at the top of it." For the instruments indicated a depth beneath them of roughly 3 miles. They were in, evidently, a large cavern of vast length and depth. The NX-1 continued slowly forward, two pairs of eyes intent on her teleview screen. Keith jotted down the tunnel's position, and the funnel-shaped hole sank away behind their slow screws. And then, upon the location chart, a faint red dot suddenly glowed. It was upon them in a flash, a small tube of metal, shaped somewhat in the form of the big octopi submarine, had darted up from below, hovered a second close to them, and then, almost before they realized they were being surveyed, sped back into the mysterious depths from which it had come. "A lookout, I suppose," Keith muttered, breathing more easily. "Couldn't have held more than two of those creatures. Well, the alarm's out, I guess, Graham, but it can't be helped. Let's see what it's like down below." They plunged steadily down, then ahead. And presently there grew on the teleview vague forms which widened their eyes and made their breath come quicker. Keith had guessed the tunnel led to a civilization of some kind, but he was not prepared for the sight that loomed hazily through the soft blue water. Strange mound-like shapes appeared far below, mounds grouped in orderly rows and clusters, with streets running between them, thronged with tiny spidery dots. Octopi. It was, the commander realized, a city of the monsters, a complete city, like those of surface peoples. For several miles in every direction the water city spread out, farther than the teleview could pierce. Wells marveled at this separately developed civilization, this deep-buried realm of octopi, whose unexpected intellectual powers had permitted such development. Perhaps, he pondered, this city was only one of many, perhaps only a village. He could but vaguely glimpse the queer mound buildings, but saw that they were of varying height and were filled with dark round entrance holes through which the creatures streamed on their different errands. He saw no schools of fish around. "I guess they've all been killed off or eaten," he commented to the wonder-struck Graham. "Probably the octopi have separate hatcheries where they raise them for food." "But good Lord," the first officer exclaimed, "a city! A city like ours! Down here, filled with octopi." "Yes," answered Wells grimly, "and this city may only be a small settlement. There may be scores of these places. We'd better continue ahead now that we're here, for we've got to get all the information we can. I only hope these monsters haven't more than one big submarine. We can expect an attack any minute." The NX-1 pressed on. The city dropped behind. A breathless tenseness had settled down over the submarine. She was proceeding with utmost caution, her anxious officers alert at the location chart. The great fear that tormented them was that they might be attacked, not by one, but by a fleet of the octopi ships. Then, at the rim of the chart, a red dot appeared. It grew rapidly, charging down on them at great speed. The spot was large. This was no small sentry boat. At once the alarm bell shrilled its warning. The crew below left their posts and raced to the control room. With sure mechanical fingers, the emergency system gripped the valve handles and motor levers. Keith swung the NX-1 onto a level keel, straightened her out, and decreased speed still more. Giving the rods of the motor and rudder controls to Graham, he moved to the small lever which would unleash his bow torpedoes, and fingered it lightly. The NX-1 was ready for action. Scarcely had the men reached the small control room than the familiar electric charge tingled. They stared wonderingly at each other, half afraid. No one seemed hurt. One hand on the torpedo lever, Wells watched his charts and instruments. He thanked God that there was only one of the enemy. The ray's shock came again, and stronger. The red dot was practically upon them. The screen was still empty. Coolly, Keith slowed the submarine to a dead stop. The crimson stud came closer. And then he saw it. It was the same fearsome hulking form, the same curving windows, dark and lifeless. The same knobs on its bow, one now leaping and pulsing with the paralyzing glow. At a distance of a few hundred feet, the octopi ship swerved to a halt, dousing the NX-1 with its ray unceasingly. Again those two underwater craft, so oddly contrasted, were face to face, and again the weapon that had once struck the American ship's crew down at their posts was directed full onto the NX-1. But it was harmless. It merely tingled, and did not paralyze. The control room sheathing held it out stoutly. The men's faces showed overwhelming relief. Keith smiled grimly. Now at least he had the devils where he wanted them. Now it was his turn to strike with a, to them, terrible, mysterious weapon. They had attacked, had failed, and now he could square up for Hemi and send a pair of torpedoes into that ship of hideous tentacles. "Port five," the ship swerved slightly. "Hold even." The enemy craft was very close. The NX-1's bow tubes were sighted in direct line. Her torpedoes could not possibly miss. This time, destruction for the octopi ship was inevitable. Keith Wells gripped the lever that held the torps in leash. "Wait!" Sparks, a bare foot from him, yelled out the word. Wells, alarmed, released his grip on the knob. The radio operator was listening intently, a circle of taut faces around his crouched back. He swung excitedly around. "For God's sake, don't fire," he cried. "Hemingway Bowman's on that submarine. He's alive and calling for you." Chapter 5. The Other Weapon. Bowman. Alive. Keith Wells let go the torpedo lever. His whole orderly plan of action was crashed in a second. For an instant he stood gaping at the radio man, forgetful of the peril outside, striving desperately to hit on some way of surmounting this unlooked-for obstacle. The idea of firing on his friend, killing Hemi Bowman with his own hand, paralyzed his brain. And in that unguarded instant the octopi struck. From the bow of the enemy submarine, slanting from another of its peculiar knobs, a narrow beam of violet light poured, cutting a vivid swath across the teleview. The huddled men stared at it, not comprehending what it was. They felt no shock of electricity, nor could they discern any other harmful effect. The ray held steadily on their bow, not varying in the slightest, for a full 30 seconds. And still none of them could feel or see any damage. Wells, however, gradually became aware that he was bathed in perspiration. The great streams of sweat were coursing down his face. A quick glance told him that every member of the crew was the same way, and then suddenly he was conscious of a wave of intense heat, which quickly became terrific. The control room was stifling.
Before he could act, the NX-1 slipped sharply to one side. A sharp hissing sound grew at her bow, climbing steadily to a shriek. Long streamers of white steam crept along the lower deck and seeped up into the control room, and then rose the fatal sound of rushing water, water pouring into the submarine from outside. For the violet beam was a heat ray, a weapon surface civilizations had not yet developed. While the NX-1's crew had stared at it in the teleview, it had melted a hole in their bow. Immediately the submarine lost trim, and the deck tilted ominously. In the face of material danger, danger from a source he understood, the commander became cool and methodical. "Then forward and break out steel collision mat, and weld it in place. Every man, you too, Sparks, and McKegney."
But, sir," stammered Graham, "do you want them to get us with their paralyzing ray?"
"You'd rather drown?" Wells flung back. Silenced, the first officer donned his sea suit, and in 30 seconds the rest of the crew had theirs on and were cluttering clumsily forward. Alone in the control room, Keith battled with the unbalancing flow of water, maneuvering with all his skill in a futile attempt to keep the NX-1 on even keel. The men forward worked with great speed, spurred on by the realization that they were fighting death itself. But even as they labored, the submarine swung in ever-increasing rolls and dips. The great weight of water she had shipped slopped back and forth. Her bow went steadily down. Keith swept her forward tanks clean of water, always conscious of the immobile, staring octopi submarine in the teleview, watching them, it seemed, curiously, and not driving home their advantage with additional bolts of the violet heat ray. Despite her commander's frantic efforts, the NX-1 fluttered down remorselessly. The cavern floor rose, and sinking with them came the octopi craft, in slow mockery of a fighting plane pursuing its stricken foe to the very ground. She struck bottom with a soft thudding jar and settled on even keel. At once Wells released the helm, jumped into his own sea suit, and stumbled down to take command. He found the steel collision mat in place, and the welding of it nearly completed. A few feathery trickles of water still seeped through on each side, but under his terse directions, the pumps were soon draining it out. The weird figures of the crew in their sea suits looked like creatures from another planet as they rapidly finished the job. "All right, up to the control room, everybody, fast," Wells roared. The men stumbled aft as rapidly as they could in their cumbersome suits. Several were already on the ladder, a few feet further, but at that moment the paralyzing ray again stabbed into the ship, and Keith Wells slumped helplessly to the deck, and as he crumpled, he glimpsed the grotesque falling figures of his men, and saw one come tumbling down the ladder from the control room, where he had almost reached safety. Peculiar sensations, unendurable thoughts raced through the commander as he lay there limply. He knew his predicament. He wanted desperately to rise, to rush to the control room. Time and time again in those first few moments of impotence, he strove mightily to pull his limbs back to life. But his greatest efforts were barren of result, save to leave him feeling still weaker. The fate that he had seen strike down Brown now enmeshed him. He was paralyzed, helpless, in the midst of his crew. After a moment, all sensation left his body. His limbs might not have existed. Sensation, pain, lived only in his brain. And there it was terrible, because self-created. He found himself sprawled flat on his back, his eyes directed stiffly upward. He could not move them, but out of the corners he vaguely sensed the other figures around him, helpless, every one. And who knew if they would ever come out of the spell? Victory had gone to the octopi. Minutes that seemed like hours passed, and then a well-remembered voice sounded in the radio earphones in his helmet. It was Hemi Bowman, speaking from the enemy ship.
"Keith! Keith Wells, are you there?" the voice cried. "Keith, what have they done to you?"
And Keith, he could not answer. He could not answer that troubled voice of his friend, that voice from a friend he had thought dead. Again Bowman spoke.
"Keith, can't you hear me? What are they doing to you?"
"Oh!" For a moment it stopped, then came once more, thick with anguish. "Oh God, what's happened?" Then lower. "If only there were light so I could see what they're doing." The voice tapered into silence.
Keith could picture Hemmy, probably bound, giving him up for dead. Then quite distinctly he heard a clank at the NX-1's bow. The submarine jerked, her bow tilted up, and with increasing speed she moved forward, silently as a ghost. Keith thought he knew what that meant. The octopi ship had grasped them with another of its hawser arms, and was pulling them away. But where to? One of those mound cities? His brain was a turmoil as he tried to imagine what was before them, but all he could do was lie there and wait. The American craft was towed for perhaps 10 minutes, 10 ages to her commander, then coasted slowly to a pause, and with a sharp jar settled to rest. As she did so, every light in her hull went suddenly out. It had been bad enough with the lights on, but the darkness was far worse. The submarine was a tomb, as silent as one, and full of men who lived and yet were dead. Hemmy Bowman's voice came no more to Wells. He was alone with his moiling doubts and fears and unanswerable questions, and he knew that every other man there was alone with them, too. As his eyes became partially accustomed to the darkness, he could distinguish vaguely the forms of the familiar mechanisms above him. A slight noise grew suddenly and resolved itself into a prolonged scraping along the outer hull of the submarine. At intervals it paused and gave way to a series of sharp, definite taps. Keith realized what those sounds signified. The octopi were striving to find some entrance to the NX-1. This, he told himself, was the end. The creatures would break through, water would rush in, and every man would drown, for the face shields of their sea suits were open. The dull scrapings ran completely around the motionless submarine, punctuated with the same staccato tappings. By the movement of the sound, Wells realized the octopi were approaching the lower starboard exit port, and as they neared that port, the noise abruptly stopped. Then for some minutes silence fell. Next the commander heard what was unmistakably the exit port's water chamber being filled, and a moment later emptied again. The devilish creatures had solved the puzzle of the means of entrance. In the awful darkness the inner door of the port swung open. A slow, slithering sound came to Wells's ears. He sensed, though he could not see, the presence of alien creature. An odor struck his nostrils, that of fish. A deliberate something crawled directly across one outstretched arm, and another across his legs, and above him loomed a monstrous, complicated shadow, which after a moment slowly melted from his line of vision. Panicky, he strove again to bring his limbs back to life, but still could not. Keith knew that in the darkness which their huge, unblinking eyes could penetrate, they were inspecting the NX-1's interior, examining the men stretched on its deck, feeling them with their cold, metal-scaled tentacles. Another complicated shadow crept back over the commander's line of sight, and from all around rose the slithering, shuffling tread of the octopi's many tentacles, rasping on the steel flooring. Sweat from Wells's forehead trickled down and stung his eyes as he lay in that dark agony. There seemed to be countless investigating tentacles feeling through the entire submarine. One of them, iron-hard, suddenly coiled under his armpit and lifted him lightly as a feather from the deck. Another snaked up and clicked his face shield securely shut. Keith heard other clicks and knew that the shields of his men were likewise being closed. The commander was held straight out from the octopus's revolting body, and as he swung, helpless, he could see that more men were grasped similarly in other mighty arms. Dangling in the shadow-filled darkness, he was carried slowly to the exit port, and he heard the inner door swing open, then close again. Water streamed through the valves. It encompassed him with a feeling of lightness, a feeling of floating, as he swung at the end of the long metal-sheathed tentacles. A moment later a soft bluish glow burst on his vision, and he saw that he was outside. There was a long wait, and when the current next swung him around, he was dismayed to see that every one of the monstrous creatures near him was dangling on high, two or three men of his helpless crew. The whole outfit was in the power of the devil fish. And then their captors moved forward with them on a ghastly march of triumph. But Keith Wells did not know that, crouched behind the instrument panel in the control room, shivering and sick with fear, was the plump form of Cook Angus McKegnie, who had just gained it just before the paralyzing ray had struck. End of chapters 4 and 5.